The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
It is. It is, and it's a Friday. We love Fridays around here because, you know, it means the weekend is upon us. Hopefully you have great plans. Now, tomorrow is a big march. A march, it's going to happen all around the country for women's rights, women's reproductive rights. I don't think this march is as well organized as the women's march that took place, you know, the day after the former guy was inaugurated. Then again, that was one of those moments in time, right? When all the stars aligned perfectly, and people turned out not only across this country, but across the globe to show not only support for women, but to stand in solidarity against the Orange Menace. This march tomorrow is for a really good cause. Obviously, we're marching to not be transported back 50 years to the time when literally women would go to somebody's basement in order to get an illegal abortion because it was the only way they could. So you've seen the logos, you know, like Texas shaped with a wire coat hanger, because that's where they're bringing us back to. Now, this march on October 2nd, I'm remiss. I don't have any of the details for you. And it's partly because I'm not going. I will be there in spirit. I'm here to cajole you into going. But again, with COVID, and I'm in Florida, remember, I'm just, you know, I'm still taking every precaution because, I don't want the COVID. So, but if you can, get out and march tomorrow because it's a thing. So this has been a week. I warned you on Monday to buckle in, that it was going to be a roller coaster ride. And it is. And today's Friday. And I'll tell you what, this roller coaster ride isn't fun. And it's not over yet. So rather than me try to explain to you what's going on, I thought I'd bring in one of the best journalists out there who is the executive editor at the Daily Prospect. They're at prospect.org. David Dayan, I pick your brain whenever I can. I so appreciate your time. I just finished reading the piece that you have up at the Prospect today, prospect.org, titled "The Progressive Caucus Wields Power." In a rare moment in Congress, progressive Democrats held the line for now. This is a moment to savor, isn't it? Because this has not historically been the case.
It's an unusual moment. It's, as you say, has not historically been the case. The history of the Progressive Caucus is a history of just sort of big ideas with no follow through. They have historically been a loosely knit group that doesn't get a whole lot of respect on Capitol Hill. And when there is a policy that they want, typically it doesn't really go forward. And when there's a policy that they don't want, they are impressed upon to vote for it anyway, and they typically go along. And that's really been the history of the Progressive Caucus, and that has started to change. And it really changed with the entry of Pramila Jayapal as first co-chair of the caucus with Mark Pocan. And then this term, she's the sole chair of the Progressive Caucus. And she has brought more of an organizing mindset to the caucus. Back in 2019, she jousted with Nancy Pelosi on a drug pricing bill and got some real concessions that became the basis for the drug pricing bill in this reconciliation package. Mm-hmm. And then what they have done this week with Hold the Line and refusing to go ahead and pass the bipartisan infrastructure bill without any kind of assurance or guarantee that there was going to be any passage of the reconciliation bill, the Build Back Better Act, this is the biggest moment for the Progressive Caucus to date. There's been nothing really like it. And now they really are enforcing the terms of power. They are enforcing the terms of legislation and commanding respect on Capitol Hill that was not really ever there.
Right. In fact, when you know, so to back up a little bit, David Day, and they made a deal some months ago when they devised this two-pronged approach to passing this massive package, right? The hard infrastructure bill, which they knew they could get some Republican votes on to pass, and to pass that during through regular order, getting 60 votes, because unfortunately that's regular now, and then do the rest of it via reconciliation. But they realized that the only way to get that done was to give both sides some leverage to get the other side to vote for them. When I'm talking about sides, I'm talking about the progressive side and the not progressive side of the Democratic caucus. And so Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, and President Biden were all in on this until just a couple of weeks ago when these 10, I hate the word, first of all, they're not moderates. And I don't even like calling them centrists because I see them more as obstructionists. Some of my listeners have said, well, corporate whore is more accurate. But whatever you want to call them, I don't think they're moderates or centrists. I just have a semantics problem there. But they, about 10 of them, came forth and said, well, we don't want to wait for the other one. Let's vote now. The Senate passed it. What are we waiting for? And then Nancy Pelosi basically the other day said, all right, let's separate the two. Thinking, if history is any prologue, that the progressives would just say, all right, we'll cut our losses and give in. But that's not what happened. So they showed their strength yesterday. It was interesting because I'm watching the corporate media, you know, tie themselves in knots, going through contortions, really trying to blame the progressives for tanking the whole thing, which first, that hasn't happened. They're not tanking it. They're just trying to get all parties to agree to the deal they already agreed to, aren't they?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, and this was a deal that didn't really even originate with the Progressive Caucus. It originated with the leadership. It really originated with Joe Biden. Joe Biden put out two bills, right? He put out an infrastructure bill, a hard infrastructure bill called the American Jobs Plan, and he put out a so-called soft or human infrastructure bill called the American Families Plan. And so for it was always a two bill process. And progressives were concerned that one was going under regular order, one was going under reconciliation, and one was prized by moderates or centrists or corporate whores or whatever. And the other was prized by progressives. So there was a real concern that if you pass one without the other, somebody was going to get left holding the bag.
Right.
And while progressives agitated for this, it was Biden, Pelosi, and Schumer who really came up with this two-track process and said, this is how we're going to do this. We're going to get everybody in. We're going to make everybody happy, give everybody something that they want. We're going to give the centrists the infrastructure package. We're going to give the progressives this human infrastructure, which is really an expansive bill around the social safety net and education and healthcare and climate and all sorts of things. And if we do this, then this is the only way with a very thin margin to keep everybody together. This is the only way.
Right.
What we saw then was the breaking of this promise or the attempt to break this promise with the bipartisan infrastructure bill that's already passed the Senate being attempted to be rammed through in the House. And progressives stood up and said no. They had many months to organize around this, right? Because the Biden plans came out in March. So, you know, they had 6 months to really talk about this and say, this is the only way that this gets done. And we're not going to sacrifice things that we've been working for decades just so They can, you know, decide that the half progress is progress. So this was a negotiated deal. We have Joe Manchin on the record saying this was the deal.
That's right.
We have everybody involved in it is on the record. This was the deal. Only later, because of their corporate donors or because of whoever, they decided to try to break the deal, and Progressives stood up and said no.
Which is great. I wanted to stand up and cheer when they stood their ground. And there's a lot of pushback. I mean, you know, I flip around the news channels. I can't stand any of them, basically. So I go back and forth. And I'm hearing, like last night, Aaron Burnett talking about the massive cost. And I just like, turn this crap off. I can't listen to it. They just want to blame the progressives for blowing up something that hasn't been blown up yet. I mean, I still feel pretty good. I mean, it's a heavy haul, but I'm trying to remain optimistic that they can get this done. But the only way they're going to get it done is if the progressives stick to their guns and say, no, we're not going to pass that other one until this one is ready and we can do it as by design together. So yesterday we find out that Joe Manchin had given his top line number, although Chuck Schumer's been telling us for months that Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema won't give him a number. Why did Chuck Schumer lie? What's with that?
I mean that's an interesting question. You know, part of the terms of that was that nothing could be negotiated until
October 1st,
which is today.
Right.
I mean, maybe that was part of it. That they signed this deal. And then there was this sort of weird Veep style scrawling in the margins where Chuck Schumer says, I'm going to try to dissuade him of all of this, this thing that he just signed. Right.
Right.
The negotiations are pretty delicate. I think that's where Manchin was in July, but he hasn't really come any further. That was sort of an opening bid that he took in July. And you know, we did hear that Manchin was talking about $1.5 trillion. That was public and in published reports. In the last month or so, I think he's stopped negotiating. And while Sinema has been at the White House four times in the last 2 days, I think, until she jetted
out
for home.
D.C. Yeah. What the hell is that about? Not like there's anything important going on in Washington right now, mind you.
Right, exactly. So I think here's one difficulty here is that Manchin and Sinema aren't on the same page. They aren't asking for the same things. Manchin, if you look at his document, is okay with a fairly modest but a legitimate change to the tax system. I mean, it's chipped down from where Biden initially proposed it, but it's probably $1 trillion, $1.5 trillion of increasing of taxes on the rich and corporations. He's okay with that.
Good.
Sinema doesn't appear to be okay with that. Sinema appears to be okay with more spending, particularly on climate. And Manchin isn't okay with that. He's got a cap on spending. He's got means testing, and he wants to put a spending cap on existing programs. He's got all these other things around spending. So you have one who wants no taxes but more spending, and the other who wants no spending but more taxes. And so it's hard. What's going to be really difficult is getting everybody together on this thing, because not only do you have the figuring out where you could thread the needle on Sinema and Manchin, or as it was told to me on Twitter, the Manchin cinematic universe. That's how we're
because I was going to ask you, is it Manchinima or is it Cinemansion?
But well, I think Manchin, the Manchin cinematic universe, I think is perfect. But not only is it going to be a problem there, but let's say we do get to a deal. And there are two ways that this could go. One is just at $1.5 trillion, that's the top number. Maybe they bump it up to $1.7, $1.9, something like that. One of the other ways that actually might end up being more lucrative than it seems like is you could call things like the child tax credit expansion, which gets $3,600 per child per year if you're under 6 years of age, and 3,000 per year if you're between 6 and 17.
Right.
You could see that as a tax cut. So that doesn't count against spending. Huh? That's a tax cut, right? And that would go into the tax ledger. And similarly, childcare expenses could be given out as a tax credit. Energy tax credits could be put into the tax bin.
Okay.
Expansions of things like the EITC, the earned income tax credit, could be put into a tax cut. So you could have maybe a trillion five in tax cuts and 1.5 trillion in spending, all of it offset by increases in the tax code and budget savings, maybe from prescription drug reform. So you could, that's a way for everybody to save face, right? Manchin
right.
says, hey, I kept the spending to 1.5 trillion. And the progressives say, well, actually we got kind of closer to 3 trillion in terms of an actual benefit, right? So that's one way this could go. And that's very optimistic and very hopeful, but it's possible. I mean, I know that's not me talking. That's
right.
actually been talked about in the White House and in these talks. Like
Good.
That is a thing that's happening.
Good. So they're thinking outside of the box. They're being creative.
Right. I mean, if that happens, great. However, I think at some point, you're going to get to a point where all of the spending that is currently in the bill is not going to be able to stay there. And the question then becomes, are we going to do a few things well, or are we going to do a bunch of things not so well? And what does not so well mean? Well, for example, in order to save costs, they are delaying the start of the Medicare expansion for dental benefits to 2028.
Wow.
So we'd have to wait 7 years for that to happen because, you know, that's a gimmick so that in the 10-year budget window, it looks cheaper than it actually is,
sure.
even though it goes on. Another thing is you could do this in a just sort of ineffective way where you give, for example, the initial ask was for $400 billion for at-home care.
Okay.
So that would increase the availability of home and community-based services for the elderly and people with disabilities, and it would raise the pay of those home care workers who are some of the lowest paid people in our entire economy. Now they're talking about $150 billion for that. And there is almost no way to accomplish the goals that you want to accomplish in at-home care with that little of an appropriation.
Right.
So are we going to live with that and just get a little, you know, less money than we need or delay the start date or do whatever? Or are we just going to say, okay, some things have to be thrown out and we're just going to do a few things well?
Now, let me ask you this, you know, somewhat, and I don't recall where I heard this, but I heard this as a possibility. This is a 10-year plan. It's $3.5 trillion over 10 years, which comes out to $350 billion a year. Joe Manchin wants to cut that in half. Just say, you know,
more than half,
right? More than half. But let's say half. What if they then say, okay, well, it's a 5-year plan.
Well, this is something that my colleague, Harold Meyerson, wrote about this week. Actually, he said, do the whole plan, but for the next 4 years and run on it in the 2024 elections.
Right.
Now there's risk reward here, right? The risk is that Republicans win the 2024 elections. And instead of something like Obamacare, where they had to affirmatively pass something to repeal it, if you only have these programs for 4 years, all they have to do is nothing, which they're really good at. And in 4 years, all of that would be gone.
Right. Like, remember, so, we used to have an assault weapons ban that lasted
exactly.
10 years and then it went away, which is
it went away.
Unbelievable.
Exactly. So you get into something like that. Mm. So that's the risk. The reward is that you give people tangible benefits. And in 2024, Joe Biden stands up if he's running for reelection and says, I gave you a child tax credit. I gave you affordable child care. I gave you a free 2-year community college.
Right.
I gave you universal pre-K. I gave you this, that, and the other thing. Vote for me and we'll keep it. Vote for my opponent and you'll lose it.
Yeah.
And that sounds effective. I mean, I don't know how much elections are even based on policy anymore, but it sounds like it could be effective because it affects people where they live, like
That's
where
right.
they are.
And once you have a benefit like that, it's really hard to take it away. And obviously,
yeah.
they'd be the ones taking it away.
That's right. Yeah. So I think there is potential there that you could see something, maybe not for everything, but maybe for some things. I mean, even right now, the child tax credit is only in the current bill, it's only extended for 4 years. So we're already doing that to a certain extent. The question is, would they be willing to do it for everything? So these are the very tough questions that they're going to have to figure out and that they're negotiating right now, right? I mean, they're trying to get some sort of terms that would be acceptable to the Progressive Caucus so that they'll pass the infrastructure bill. Now, Pramila Jayapal has said the only way that you're going to get us to pass it is the Senate is going to pass that reconciliation bill first.
Right.
If the Senate passes that bill first, then we'll be happy to pass both bills in the House. I don't know that every member of the Progressive Caucus is going to agree to that. There are some that might say, okay, if we have a framework in place, I'll trust that the framework will go forward, which, you know, you can believe that or not. But I think there are some members who might say that, and there might be enough members to then get the bill across the line.
Right.
That's what we're going to see. We could see it today. I doubt it. I think there's a lot more negotiation that needs to be taken here, but that's what Pelosi, I think, is trying to set up. Give a framework that's good enough to get enough, peel off enough progressives in order to pass this infrastructure bill.
Right. And the other thing to keep in mind is, you know, they had a deal before that they're going to do this two-pronged approach, and then they tried to go back on it. So why would the progressives trust them to come up with a framework and say, okay, they're going to do this, we'll do this, that's the deal? Well, no, you already showed us how much these deals mean to you. I'd be hesitant on that.
Yeah, I mean, and the larger issue is there's just a lack of trust, not only just between progressives and conservative Democrats, but there's a lack of trust sort of in the institution. I mean, how many big things have we passed in the last 10 years? I mean, you can count them on one hand,
right?
And so there's just so many hurdles to getting something big done, especially something this big with majorities this small, that there's a real wariness of taking someone on faith that something will get done.
Of course.
And so that's what you're going to have to break through. And there's going to have to be a moment where everybody says, all right, we're all leaping off this bridge together.
Right. But there has to be trust there. And right now it doesn't exist. By the way, Joe Manchin was up on Capitol Hill today. He met with the Democratic caucus, and a report says that just after the meeting, here's a quote from the president: it doesn't matter when, it doesn't matter whether it's in 6 minutes, 6 days, or 6 weeks, we're going to get it done.
That's, I mean, that's good to hear, because it has now taken the urgency, the timeline urgency out.
Yeah.
And there is no urgency. There's nothing in that bill. Now, Pelosi was trying to create some urgency, because this gets a little complicated, but the infrastructure bill is actually two bills.
Right.
So one part of it is new spending. It's about $550 billion over 8 years of new spending on roads and bridges and broadband and the electric grid and resiliency from climate and things like that. The other half of the bill is the routine, what they call the surface transportation reauthorization. That's just highway spending that the government does every year. It's paid for out of the gas tax. And they take the money from the gas tax and give it out to the states for various infrastructure projects, mostly highways and transit.
Okay.
So that expires every so often.
Right.
Surface transportation expires every so often.
And in fact, wasn't it?
It expired September 30th. So what Pelosi was trying to do is say, hey, we got to pass this infrastructure bill or else this highway funding is going to expire. And what are we going to do then? Well, the truth of the matter is that and a source on the Hill told me this, there has been a short-term extension of surface transportation 28 times since 2003. It happens over and over again. They do a short-term fix until they can get agreement on the larger package, which is exactly what we're doing right now. So today, Peter DeFazio, the chair of the Transportation Committee in the House, said, we're going to do a 30-day fix of surface transportation, a short-term extension. No one will be furloughed. No one will lose their job. We'll keep the highway funding flowing for another 30 days. So that gives 30 days breathing room to come to an agreement. And it's going to take at least that long. This thing is going into overtime. This, I could see it being tied to the next, because we did a short-term funding of the government.
Till December 3rd.
This week, till December 3rd. That could be a deadline.
But we also have... on another topic, October 18th for the debt ceiling. It's like one
that's
thing.
That's a totally separate track. And that's the most dangerous thing happening right now, really, is that the House and Senate have said, Democrats have said they're not going to use reconciliation for that. They are going to force Mitch McConnell to either A, give up votes for the debt ceiling, or B, just change, allow unanimous consent to allow Democrats to pass the debt ceiling change on their own. And McConnell thus far has said, I'm not doing that. And, we're playing this big game of chicken with the U.S. economy right now.
Right. And the consequences, we've never defaulted as a nation before, and we've come up against the cliff many times, but never gone over it. But Mitch McConnell is the obstructionist. He's the Grim Reaper who's brought his scythe back out or something. And it makes no sense because, he's talking about, I'm not going to give them a blank check to keep this ridiculous spending spree. Well, it's not about the spending that they're doing now. This is basically just saying we're going to pay the bills for the spending that we already approved. Why isn't that just built in when Congress passes a spending bill that they say, and by the way, we're going to pay the bills, so there's no need for a debt ceiling anymore?
Yeah, this is a stupid, absurd law. It shouldn't exist. It doesn't exist in most economies because it's stupid. It's exact everything that you said. The House used to have a thing called the Gephardt rule, which would, as you say, deem in every budget, as soon as they pass a budget, it says all the spending in this budget is hereby, Treasury has the ability to borrow to cover it. That's one way that Congress has handled this in the past. But, there are ways that the executive, that Joe Biden and his administrative branch can handle this. One of the ways is by simply saying that it would be unconstitutional to not be able to issue debt. There, the 14th Amendment, Section 4 says the validity of the public debt shall not be questioned. And you could make an argument that it is literally unconstitutional to have this restriction. You can say that on one end, Congress is giving like two separate and distinct directives to the executive. One, they're saying spend this money. And two, they're saying you can't borrow to cover this spending.
Right.
And so let's do the least unconstitutional thing and cover the spending rather than not spend the money, because you're not allowed to do that either, right?
If you're
the executive.
Right.
So that's one thing. The other thing is, and maybe this sounds wacky, but again, we're dealing with a stupid thing.
Yes, we are.
The Treasury has the ability to mint platinum coins of any denomination and deposit them at the Federal Reserve to cover any sort of debt that would be incurred. And it's a completely constitutional law. It was passed by Congress, and the Treasury can mint the coin and end this nonsense. And they can mint a coin of $20 quadrillion, any denomination they want, to just never make this an issue ever, ever, ever again.
And they should just do that. They need to get rid of this as an issue. The thing is, and it's so frustrating, and I think, the Democrats don't do a good job of laying out the facts, because the American people, one, have a short attention span, and two, as we've learned, given the fact that 70% of Republicans still believe that, Joe Biden didn't win the election, it's opposite world. You can't underestimate the stupidity of the American people. So they need to be told what's happening. During the last 4 years when Trump was in office, we didn't have to deal with the debt ceiling because the Democrats didn't put us in this position. They went along with them and said, okay, we'll suspend it for a year. They suspended it twice. It never came up in those 4 years because the Democrats weren't willing to do that. And I don't think there's enough of that. One thing Trump was really good at, it turned my stomach, but he was really good at patting himself on the back, usually for things that were untrue. The Democrats need a cheerleader out there to say, look, this is what they're doing. And the American people need to understand that. But the media won't even do that anymore. They're so concerned with the both-siderism that they, you know, they're bending over backwards to try to blame the progressives for daring to try to hold true to this deal they made.
Right. I mean, these are complicated issues, right? If you talk to someone on the street, they would not be able to tell you what the debt limit is.
Nope.
They would not be able to tell you what budget reconciliation is. They would not be able to tell you pretty much anything
in this
process. I've talked to Hill reporters that say they don't really kind of know what's going on. So it's very complex and it's very multifaceted. And it's hard to make a coherent argument. This bill is hard to explain in one sentence, right?
Yes.
I mean, there really haven't been many priorities set. They didn't say we'll do this and not that or that and not this. And of course, the entire reason for that is the filibuster, right? I mean, if this was the Great Society and the opposition wasn't filibustering every bill in sight, you would do one bill on paid leave, and then you would do one bill on drug prices, and you do one bill on community college free tuition, and you do, and so on and so on. And you build momentum with every win. But now, because every bill gets filibustered by the minority, you have to put all of your bills into one thing that end runs the filibuster, which is this reconciliation process. And you have to, you know, operate thusly. And that makes it very hard to message to the public because it's a bill with 50 components in it.
Right.
And so, yeah.
It's also hard to message to the public the whole thing about the filibuster, which is not in the Constitution. It's this artificial construct that has been abused over the last few years. It's gotten worse and worse. And then you've got Joe Biden saying, well, I'm not in favor of getting rid of the filibuster. Well, don't shoot us in the foot. I mean, that's what's going on here. So it's frustrating. It's frustrating on every front. They need to get rid of the filibuster. The Senate is supposed to be democracy is majority rule, isn't it?
Yeah, you would think. If ever there was something that would stiffen the resolve of every member of the Democratic caucus to end the filibuster, even if it's just in that particular circumstance, it would be the full faith and credit of the United States government, right? I mean, wouldn't that be the one thing to preserve and prevent a absolutely catastrophic scenario of a huge recession, if not a depression? Wouldn't you think that Joe Manchin, no matter how much he reveres the filibuster, or Kyrsten Sinema, no matter how much she reveres it, wouldn't they be willing to give it up so that the majority can work its will and pass and a suspension of the debt limit?
Right.
You'd think that would be the one bill that we could get done in that fashion. Now, another bill we should be able to get done that fashion is voting rights.
Hello.
But that hasn't happened yet. And Manchin's name is on the bill, right?
Okay.
I mean, like, he's now negotiated the actual bill. He was a Secretary of State in West Virginia.
Wow.
You know, I mean, he knows this issue and should be able to agree that should be done. But you know, let's maybe walk before we can run. Can we start with the debt limit?
Right.
Let's get rid of that in a majority vote process, and maybe we'll think, hey, that felt pretty good. We got something done. We didn't have to go through torture. So why don't we try it again for voting rights?
Right.
And why don't we try it again for everything?
Exactly. Let me ask you this, Dave. If the Republicans were to, God forbid, knocking on wood laminate here, take back control of Congress in 2022, please, no. But if they were, do you have any doubt that they would get rid of the filibuster?
Oh, I mean, well, this is the thing about the difference between the parties, though, is that Republicans aims, their goals in legislative action can be done without the filibuster.
Right.
They want to lower taxes, they want to slash regulations, and they want right-wing judges to be confirmed. Well, right-wing judges, you only need 50 votes.
Because they got rid of the filibuster for judicial appointments.
Right. Cutting taxes, you can do through the budget reconciliation process,
right,
which they did in 2017.
Yep.
And the third thing, cutting regulations, you can do at the agency level. So you can do it when you're a president, you have control of the regulatory apparatus. You can just do that yourself. So they don't need to get rid of the filibuster. It's not important to them. It's
right,
not necessary to them. All of the things that they do can be done under a 50-vote threshold. Most of the things that Democrats want to do need a 60-vote threshold.
Right.
And that's the difference between the parties.
It's amazing. And the thing is, it's not like they ever do anything constructive. It's a lot of tearing down. And they want to do away with things that we have access to. It is. And the other really scary part is if we don't fix the voting rights part of it, Democrats can keep winning elections. We do. We win in popular votes. But, you know, they'll keep cheating and stealing the elections, trying to overturn them, as we saw how close they came. And now they're putting the ball in motion in every state to try to take control of the voting election process. So if they don't like the results, they'll just throw them out and put their own results in. And then none of this will matter anymore because we won't have any rights to worry about.
It's very concerning. And the thing about it is that because elections are administered at the state and local level, I don't know what the mechanism is from a federal legislative standpoint to actually stop the changeover of, election administration officials into the hands of right-wing legislatures, yeah, or new appointees, or, you know, there's nothing in H.R. 1 that says you, Georgia, cannot take over Fulton County's counting system. There's nothing in H.R. 1 to fix that. And I don't know what it would be. I don't know what it would take to fix that.
So there's nothing in either, even in the John Lewis?
Not about the counting. I mean, you know, the John Lewis Act says that there has to be some certain standards in terms of access to the ballot. But we're talking about the counting of the ballot.
The counting of it.
You're talking about the counting of the ballot.
Done at the state level.
There's nothing that really says in either of those bills, like, you have to have nonpartisan administrators of the election. That's not a thing. That's not something that we've contemplated. So that's what's almost more concerning. Now, in 2020, when the attempts were made to essentially overturn the election result, you had a few Republican officials in various states, Georgia, Pennsylvania, and what have you, who said, no, we're not going to go along with that. We believe in this count and we're going to move forward. And all those people, it seems like, are going to lose their elections if they're elected officials, or they're going to get tossed out by legislatures or somebody if they are unelected officials. And we're going to have a very different landscape in 2024 in terms of who is making those decisions rather than 2020. And certainly the courts can get involved, and they will. And Democrats, like people like Mark Elias, are already suing in many states over these changes in law. But ultimately, where's that going to go? That's going to lead all the way up and up and up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court has played, shown its cards when it comes to election law. So it's very dangerous. I'm not sitting here with a good answer for you on how we remedy that.
No, but people need to know the danger is out there, and we need to work towards some kind of fix. And unfortunately, I don't see that happening. I'm hoping that Mark Elias and the others who are in a position to deal with this are going full steam ahead and doing something, because I feel powerless and really scared.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what to tell you. It's it, 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 I mean, the the We have to distinguish between what the problems are. There are issues with access to voting. I think those are surmountable.
Right.
I think with organization, with the kinds of things that you saw in Georgia, where access to the ballot was not necessarily guaranteed in 2020, and yet mm-hmm. we still won elections. Those kinds of things are surmountable. Voter ID, things like that. You organize and it's a massive effort, but you put a lot of money into it and you can get it done.
Right.
It's the election administration stuff on the one hand, and then the gerrymandering stuff on the other hand, where the elected officials pick their voters rather than the other way around.
Yep.
Those things, those things are much more difficult to fix. And we're already seeing the maps start to come out, where in Texas, for example, where you had a lot of swing seats, you had a lot of seats that Republicans were barely holding on to. Mm-hmm. All of those seats have now been made Republican plus 15, Republican plus 20 seats. However, I mean, they didn't, you know, they did a lot of incumbent protection, but they didn't sort of gerrymander so that they could win more seats. So that's actually kind of interesting. And I think the redistricting situation in 2020 doesn't look as bleak as it did in 2010. I mean, it depends on the state, obviously, but I think it's not going to be as bad. I think Republicans are going to try to cut their losses rather than be really aggressive and try to gerrymander these states in a way that, you know, you have a 50-50 state that has 75% Republicans in Congress or
right.
or like that.
Yeah, but you know, look, I just look at Florida, where 10 years ago we passed a constitutional amendment, Fair Districts Florida. Our districts were supposed to be drawn by independent, nonpartisan groups, and they've completely ignored it. And so, mm-hmm. you know, I'm waiting to see the maps. I know what it's going to be, and it's not going to have anything to do with the constitutional amendment we passed. This is the Republican Party in the Trump years. What they don't like, they just ignore and act like it's not there, right?
Right.
It's like the truth.
Yeah.
Just ignore it. Say it didn't happen. Like Trump going to his rally the other day and saying the fraud in Arizona showed that he won. And no, it didn't.
Right.
And this is because people don't listen. They listen to this con man and believe what he says.
Yeah. And, you know, it's all the more reason why this process that we're talking about, the legislative process,
yeah.
has to lead to a positive result.
Absolutely.
Because if it's a situation where you have these threats to democracy and Joe Biden's sitting at 42% approval rating, then forget about it, right?
Right.
I mean, but if it's a situation where Biden has a successful presidency and he's doing the things that he needs to do to win re-election, or if he's not running for some other Democrat that succeeds him to win election, then we can fight it out in the courts and figure out ways to expand participation and make sure that we you know, aren't succumbing to the big lie.
Right.
So that's what makes governing, because ultimately this is supposed to be about governing and it's supposed to be about solving problems. That's what makes that so much more important and why we really need a resolution that is as expansive as it needs to be to give Democrats a fighting chance in the next
right.
several weeks.
And here's a pep talk for the listeners of this program, who many were getting discouraged over the last few days, thinking, oh, they're going to blow it. We need to cheer them on. We need to make them, you know, let the progressives know they're doing the right thing. As Joe Biden said, it could take 6 days, 6 weeks. It's okay. It'll get done. We need to make sure it gets done. And we need to tell people not to get discouraged and not to be the naysayers, because, you know, that influences things. This can happen. We deserve nice things. And we're finally in a position where we can actually get them. Oh, my God, what a concept.
Right. And that is in large part due to the work of the Progressive Caucus for not lying down, for not giving up their votes, for setting these terms and saying, we want the deal that we were promised. We want the deal that we asked for. And I think what happened this week has put the Biden agenda on stronger footing. Mm-hmm. It's more likely now that some sort of reconciliation bill happens, whereas it was kind of wavering in the last week. I do think something will get done. I don't know what it's going to look like. It might not be completely acceptable to every progressive Democrat, but I think it's much more likely that the outcome will be much more acceptable to progressives now than it would have been a week ago.
Without a doubt. David Dayan, if you have time, I got to ask you about one other thing that I don't even know if you're...
I kind of got to go.
Oh, but, you got to go. Yeah. Breaking news since you've been on with me. OZY okay. Media? Done.
Ozzy. They're done?
Done. Pulled the plug. They're done. I'm trying to find the actual announcement, but they're done. Pulled the plug. And apparently...
Oh, that's very funny because I was on another radio show that has rants at the end of the show from across the political spectrum. And my rant was about Ozzy. And now it's going to be out of date when it runs this weekend.
Oh, how funny. It's done. It's over.
Wow.
And yeah, so I'm trying to find it, but I just, all of a sudden, here it is. At Ozzy, we have been blessed with a remarkable team of dedicated staff. Many of them are world-class journalists and experienced professionals to whom we owe tremendous gratitude and who are wonderful colleagues. It is therefore with the heaviest of hearts that we must announce today that we are closing Ozzy's doors.
Wow, this is amazing. And just for a little backstory for the audience, like this guy, Carlos Watson, is like the music man. He was a complete compulsive pathological liar.
Wow.
He claimed that Ozzy had 50 million audience reach when it had something in the hundreds of thousands monthly. He claimed that YouTube was this huge partner and that he was, they were doing all these things with YouTube. And he got one of his own staffers to impersonate a YouTube executive on a call with Goldman Sachs, who was a potential investor in Ozzy. He claimed that his television show was going to be on A&E, and he got told the producers this and the guests and everything, and the producers found out that it wasn't even on A&E's schedule.
Right.
I mean, this guy is a charlatan, like a complete charlatan, and he snookered everybody and was raking in millions and millions of dollars in terms of venture capital and things like this. And it just shows like if you are shameless enough in our modern corporate economy that you can get ahead. You don't have to deliver a product. You don't have to deliver a benefit to anybody. You just have to lie. It's a business
model. You have to be a good bullshitter. Elizabeth Holmes is on trial this week because she did the same thing.
Wow. But here's the thing, and I actually wrote today at the American Prospect, it's for our next print issue, I did a review of four books, one about Tesla, one about Amazon, one about Facebook, and one about WeWork. Remember WeWork?
Oh, yeah.
That was another bullshit artist. So what I found is that all these CEOs, they're the same. They're all sociopaths. And the only difference is whether their business manages to survive or not. And if it implodes, then they're condemned. They're grifters. They're charlatans. They're snakes. And if it thrives, they're just respected members of the business community.
Right.
And you know, they're crazy, but only in the way that visionaries are crazy.
Oh my God.
And we should respect them. And they have to be doing something right because everybody loves them. I mean, what Ozzy was doing, faking its stats to show greater audience reach, is exactly what Facebook was doing to advertisers. They were faking their stats to show that they had millions more people watching their videos than they said they had. At one point, Facebook said that they had 25 million more young people on the site than there are young people in the United States.
God.
I mean, they are also shameless liars. They just won. And so their con paid off. And now we have to respect them. But this is a diseased corporate culture. And that's the larger point.
Yes, it is. And that goes back to your book, Monopolize, that people should read, David Dayan. This has been a hell of a week. We have more coming up. I just have to show you on your way out the graphic that I made for today's show. I put you in really good company.
I know. I saw that. Thank you.
So there you are. That was the week that was. David Dayan, thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye.
There you go. David Dayan. He's so good. I infringe on his time. I try not to, but I do. So we've got about 10 minutes left in our week, the week that was. there's a couple other things. If you'd like to call in and comment on anything you just heard, anything that happened this week, like I said, we've got a few minutes left. Phone lines are open, 954-889-6410. If you're on Skype, you can Skype in to Nicole Sandler. But I'm looking over this deal, this secret deal that Chuck Schumer signed with Joe Manchin. And some of the provisions in here are just unbelievable. I think I told you some of this yesterday. He wants assurances that fossil fuel subsidies will not be repealed if new credits are issued for renewable power. Well, that defeats the purpose, doesn't it? And that any electric vehicle subsidies be extended to also include hydrogen-powered vehicles? Again, defeats the purpose. Again, innovation, not elimination of energy sources. Well, no, we need to get off of fossil fuels. So Joe Manchin, I guess, he's from West Virginia. He wants to keep coal alive. I hate to second guess the president. And I know that Biden has met separately with both Manchin and Sinema numerous times this week. I don't know what he's saying to Sinema. Probably saying, first of all, learn how to dress appropriately for the job. Second of all, what the fuck is wrong with you, bitch? No, I'm sure he didn't go there. I would. But to Manchin, why doesn't he say, look, I will reinvent your coal industry. I will train all of your coal miners and everybody who works in a coal mine to be in the green energy business. And that's part of this whole package anyway, the reconciliation part of it, because it deals with climate change. It deals with getting off of fossil fuels. It deals with bringing in renewable energies. It deals with all that stuff, with making things better. But Joe Manchin is just, you can't reason with him. Did you hear what he said? Hold on, caller. I'll get to you in 1 minute. But this was Joe Manchin's comment to a reporter who asked about, the progressive priorities.
I've never been a liberal in any way, shape, or form.
Hold on 1 second.
There's no one has ever thought I was. Yeah. I've been governor, I've been state secretary of state, I've been state legislature, I've been a U.S. senator, and I have voted pretty consistently all my whole life. I don't fault any of them who believe that they're much more progressive and much more liberal. God bless them. And
you're
all
right.
They need to do is we have to elect more, I guess, for them to get theirs, elect more liberals.
For them to get theirs, we have to elect more liberals. Smartest thing he's ever said. All right, to the phones. Someone calling from 310. Hi, who's this?
Hi, it's Lynn again.
I called Lynn a couple
days ago about that Harold Meyerson article.
Oh, right.
Strategy
for
passing the reconciliation.
But
now, today, I heard a new idea.
Okay.
Get rid of Manchin, trying to woo Manchin and Sinema. Instead, we should all call Chuck Schumer and tell him, lobby Lisa Murkowski, who is not a Republican, not a Democrat, she's an independent, and this could help her state very much. She might be more reasonable than the Democrats, the so-called Democrats.
Right.
Also, maybe Susan Collins. All we need are two Republicans if we could get moderate Republicans. What do you think about that
Well,
idea?
Well, Susan Collins,
I'll let you
can't...
go. I'll just...
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you, Lynn. Always good to hear from you. Susan Collins, I can't trust... as far as I can throw her, and I can't throw her. She's the one who said she's pro-choice. Whoops, that's the wrong one. I'm on the wrong button here. Where's my bullshit button? Here it
bullshit.
Is. So Susan Collins said she was pro-choice. No, she's not. And when she voted to confirm Brett Kavanaugh, who, by the way, diagnosed with COVID today, said, sorry, I'm got everything bombarding me at once. When she voted to confirm Brett Kavanaugh, she said, oh, he'll do the right thing. Yeah, or it made some nonsensical comment that proved false. Okay, to the phones. Hi, David.
Hi.
Hi.
So, a couple of things. First of all, Joe Manchin's constituents may be coal miners, but his donors are coal producers. He doesn't give a fuck about bringing anything into the 21st century.
That's true.
Not a single nano fuck.
Yep.
Speaking of fucking, fuck Kyrsten Sinema. That's number two.
Yeah.
Number three, a doctor on CNN earlier was talking about the new Merck COVID drug.
Yes.
And he said that it alters your mRNA.
Yeah.
In order to fight off the COVID.
Oh, no.
So now,
your mRNA?
Now it's guaranteed that if we take that drug, it's going to turn us all into gay communists.
Of course.
Who will vote Democratic and bring Haitians into Texas.
Yeah. Will it make me magnetic too? Because I've been told I have a magnetic personality.
Yeah.
I'm
That's one way of describing it.
All right. Yeah.
Love you, Maddie. Bye.
Love you too. Bye. That's my husband, in case you were wondering. Yeah. I don't know. Yes, it was Susan Collins said that he's learned his lesson. He hasn't learned anything, nor has she. And if you trust Susan Collins, I got some swampland not too far from here that I'm happy to sell you at a bargain price. Yay. So the week that was hell, is to be continued. So what happened this week? Well, we didn't shut down the government because the Democrats stripped out the raising of the debt ceiling from the funding bill, and therefore they were able to pass it. But there were still 35 senators, Republican senators in the U.S. Senate, who voted to shut the government down, who voted against funding the government. I don't understand, and I know it's not half of this country anymore, but everybody who identifies as a Republican, still, I gotta ask, what are you thinking about? Maybe we'll do that next week. I will ask people who identify as Republicans still today to call in so I can understand what you're trying to think. I saw something today on Twitter. There was a statistic. Let me see if I can't find it because I retweeted it. That so many people want to secede from the. Here it is. Breaking: a majority of Trump voters say they're in favor of seceding from the union in a new poll. And my response to that was good. They should go and take Mississippi, Arkansas, Alabama, West Virginia, Indiana, North Dakota, South Carolina, Tennessee, West Virginia, Wyoming, Nebraska, Texas, and perhaps a few others with them and see how far they get before they come begging the rest of the civilized world, the rest of the country, for money. Because they will go broke. Because when you look at how much the blue states contribute to the national treasury and how much the red states contribute and what they take, there's no contest. They can't support themselves. So go ahead, Trumpers, red staters, you secede. You form your own nation, the Confederate States of America, because that's where your heart lies anyway, right? So, and the good people who are in those states, come on, you know, come to the blue states. We'll take you in. There should be some kind of a, you know, an amnesty, an open border situation for any, you know, Democratic, progressive American who believes in democracy in the United States to come and we'll take care of you because that's what Democrats do. And those people who want to secede in those states can go support themselves. And let's see how far they get. It's going to be like the kid who runs away from home and then hides under the back porch because they have nowhere else to go. And when everybody's sleeping, they sneak into the house to take food out of the kitchen. That's what you would get. I want to call them on their bluff. Those secessionists. You go for it. Leave! Don't let the door hit you in the ass on the way out. Or better yet, do. Because you deserve it. All right. I'm filling in for Brad Friedman on the broadcast tonight at 8 p.m. on the Progressive Voices Network or bradblog.com right around that same time. And I'm going to run my interviews with Nikki Fried and Charlie Crist to show that Flora, duh, can get past the DeSantis problem. All right. Thank you for listening, everybody. Have a great, great weekend. I will leave you with the news, such as it is. And I'll see you over at Brad's place. Bye.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Well, at least they stopped a government shutdown, so we got that going for us. President Biden signed a continuing resolution Thursday night, just hours before the deadline, that'll keep the government funded through December 3rd. It also includes $6.3 billion to help Afghan refugees resettle in the U.S. and another $29 billion for disaster relief. But still hanging out there? The debt ceiling, which must be raised by October 18th in order to avoid a catastrophic default, which is apparently what the Republicans want. Go figure. Then there's the infrastructure package. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi insisted there would be a vote on Thursday on the BIF until there wasn't. Reportedly, the speaker spent most of the day working with the White House to come up with a framework to pass the president's full Build Back Better agenda, both the BIF, the hard infrastructure bill, and the reconciliation package, trying to satisfy both Manchinima, or is it Cinemanchin, and the Progressive Caucus. Sources say that progress was made, but they're not quite there yet. Pelosi again insisted that the House will vote on the BIF on Friday. In a Thursday night call, Pramila Jayapal, the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, encouraged her members to hold firm and not accept any kind of Build Back Better framework before the Senate actually votes on a bill. She stressed a point that the mainstream corporate media, in its efforts to vilify the progressives, simply will not report. And that is that even at this point, neither the White House nor Democratic leadership are asking the progressives to drop their demands and back a standalone vote on the BIF. That indicates that the White House believes the pressure is necessary in order to retain the leverage to get the full package passed. One big revelation on Thursday, though, Senator Joe Manchin revealed a document that both he and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer signed back in July that spells out Joe Manchin's top line number in order to get his support for that Build Back Better bill. It was $1.5 trillion and included a few other ridiculous demands. But the takeaway here is Chuck Schumer knew Manchin's position 2 months ago, but insisted on saying that the obstructionist senator wouldn't give a top-line number. Meanwhile, Politico is reporting that Pelosi's latest offer to Manchin was a top line of $2.1 trillion, broken into three sections: family care, health care, and climate change. They still got a long way to go. In COVID news, it appears that vaccine mandates are working. Several states are seeing very high compliance rates and increased vaccination rates as vaccine mandate deadlines approach. But of course, there's also pushback. Some public school teachers in New York asked the Supreme Court to block New York City's vaccine mandate for in-person staff that was set to go into effect on Friday, October 1st. But as usual, the corporate media keeps burying the lead and amplifying the wrong message. Mehdi Hassan explains.
This Washington Post article headlined, North Carolina hospital system fires about 175 workers in one of the largest ever mass terminations due to a vaccine mandate. Wow, that sounds like a lot. But read a few lines in and you see what should have been the headline. Novant Health said that more than 99% of the system's 35,000 employees have followed the mandatory vaccination program. And check out this headline from The Hill. 39 quit Kansas City area health system over vaccine mandate report. Uh-oh, sounds like those mandates are causing big problems down there in Kansas City. Until you read three sentences in and see that the people who quit are less than 1% of all staff. 99% complied with the mandate, less than 1% quit. I mean, I'm no mathematician, but isn't that an almost 100% success rate?
Some encouraging news, the pharmaceutical company Merck announced that they've developed a new antiviral pill to treat COVID-19. They say their clinical trial found it will cut the risk of hospitalization and death in half. Merck plans to ask for emergency authorization as soon as possible. As the Supreme Court is set to begin their next term on Monday, the first Monday in October, Justice Brett Kavanaugh on Thursday night tested positive for COVID-19, but is reportedly without symptoms of any illness. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said in a memo to Immigration and Border Agency officials on Thursday that officers could no longer deport migrants just because they're undocumented. This is big. Mayorkas said new guidelines call for ICE officers to focus on arresting and deporting only people deemed to pose a threat, such as terrorism, espionage, or other serious crimes. Under these new guidelines, ICE officers cannot arrest and deport undocumented immigrants who have been contributing members of their communities, including faith leaders, farm workers, or frontline health workers. But unfortunately, we end on a sour note. Your mail service will get slower and more expensive beginning now, the beginning of October. And you can thank the former guy for that, as Louis DeJoy, his pick for Postmaster General, is still in that position and is implementing his 10-year plan, ironically called Delivering for America. In addition to slowing down first-class mail delivery times while raising the postage for a first-class stamp from 55 to 58 cents, the Postal Service also dropped its on-time delivery targets. That's the percentage at which it says mail should arrive on time, to the lowest point in recent history. Hashtag Fire DeJoy. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is fully listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.